With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Farmers in Shasta, Scott River regions still face state water restrictions. After storms dramatically increased snowpack and reservoir levels this year, a March 23 executive order by the governor temporarily suspended drought curtailment orders for some watersheds. But farmers in the Shasta and Scott watersheds respectively remain under drought emergency restrictions until at least April 30th and May 2nd, state officials say. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. CFBF Legislative Day Recap. California Farm Bureau members recently visited the Capitol to talk directly with their representatives. Shannon Douglas, First Vice President, with some insight on the day.
It's great to, in some ways, I still feel like we're coming back from COVID things sometimes, and getting back into offices and having that accessing it is so important. So we had over 200 members come in person to walk the halls and really talk to their elected members and say, here are our challenges, here's what's going on, here's why agriculture is important in your area. I was able to do some of our visits to our more urban members and talking about there's actually this much production in your county, for example. And that was really good. And I think it's so good for our members to remember, yes, like we have a voice and we need to use it. We need to show up and speak up and have positive conversations. And it was a great event.
And now here's Brian German with more Ag News.
EPA's pesticide assessment process and registrations could mean some new things for growers to be aware of. Vice President of Technical Services with the National Cotton Council, Dan Parker, provides details on the development of new requirements.
So it's going to be very new. It's going to be very unusual for our producer community, because on every pesticide, there will be a small box that will be put on there that will have a caption of endangered species protection, something in that order. It's a requirement that before anyone uses this product, they must go to a website called Bulletins Live 2. On that website, it basically shows on the screen, you'll see a picture of a map, and there's three different things to input. And the producer will input the EPA registration number for the product, they will input their field location, and they will input the anticipated application date, the month that this will be applied. This is to be done within 6 months of the application. And then whenever you put that information in, the program will generate a bulletin. And that bulletin will be specific to your location, and it may or may not include some additional label restrictions.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture and the California State Board of Food and Agriculture will be tracking successes as part of the Ag Vision for the next decade. CDFA Secretary Karen Ross said that there will be metrics used as a basis for keeping track of progress in the five key priority areas of the Ag Vision.
So we will be housing it. There is a website for us, for people who are wanting to learn more about or get the full document themselves of Ag Vision. And the State Board is really the instigator and the sponsor of this. So the State Board will be incorporating this into their ongoing schedule of monthly meetings and forums that they are conveners of. And then we are setting metrics for each one of our objectives that we will take on the responsibility of reporting on those for a progress report or a dashboard.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Strawberries resistant to disease proven successful. According to UC Davis research, roughly 88% of strawberries grown in the nation come from California. Fusarium wilt is one of the most common reasons for crop loss and death, and yet 55 to 59% of cultivars planted in the state since 2014 have not been resistant. Now, agricultural researchers have released 5 strawberry varieties that can stand the test against the common disease, all while producing quality fruit and replace susceptible plants on the market. Scientists in UC Davis's strawberry breeding program have worked to release 5 strawberry varieties, including UC Eclipse, UC Golden Gate, UC Keystone, UC Monarch, and UC Surfline, to be sold to California nurseries that have proven to be resistant of Fusarium wilt. Steve Knapp, a distinguished professor in the Department of Plant Sciences and the director of UC Davis's strawberry breeding program, says, quote, "These provide the same yield or better, and they're Fusarium resistant," adding, quote, "They have a better collection of traits, They're superior. This is the first release from the UC Davis breeding program where all the cultivars have Fusarium wilt resistance. One of the varieties was also developed for mechanical harvesting. You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Farm employers' labor service compliance posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, forecasts are indicating a large uptick in renewable diesel production in the U.S. A number of factors are fueling renewable diesel's fast growth. In a recent study on renewable diesel, the University of Illinois reported that production is booming, driven by federal and state policies, including the low-carbon fuel standard in California. The Department of Energy predicts renewable diesel production could be more than double by the end of 2025, based on several announcements for projects that are either under construction or could start development soon. The DOE reported that U.S. renewable diesel production reached 2.6 billion gallons in 2022, and by the end of 2025, they think production could reach 5.9 billion gallons a year. During a webinar hosted by the Northern Crops Institute, market analyst Mike Kruger talked about the expanding renewable diesel market.
Remember, renewable diesel is made 100% from vegetable oil, whereas biodiesel is still the majority is comprised of petroleum. And the government, the U.S. government, has made comments, and in their outlook conferences, they have not reflected the significant increase that most of the private people in this country are gearing up for in renewable diesel production. But understand that companies like Bunge, they're kind of leading the charge, and others are partnering with the major oil companies. Bunge just announced a few days ago the acquisition of a multi-oil processing facility at the Gulf. The chairman or the president of Bunge a month or two ago said that they're really not concerned about what the government says about biofuels, renewable diesel, tax credits and that sort of thing going forward, that they think this thing's going to happen with or without the government.
The expansion of renewable diesel production includes facilities in the Northern Plains.
We now have a couple of soybean processing plants under construction in North Dakota. A third one, I think, is pretty much set to break ground this spring. By the time those plants are online, in a couple of years, they will consume roughly 150 million bushels of North Dakota's 200 million bushels of soybean production, which means that, of course, great competition between the soybean processors and the exporters in North Dakota, Western Minnesota, South Dakota. It also means that the flow of raw soybeans to the West Coast is going to slow pretty dramatically. In my opinion, it means that we're going to be exporting more soybean meal than raw soybeans. And of course, that means we're going to have to update export facilities to handle meal instead of soybeans. And the trade will do that. I'm not concerned about that.
Similar things are happening in Canada as it relates to canola and building out renewable diesel capacity.
So the point is that, you know, the oil leg of soybean processing has been the weak leg forever, and now it's going to be an equal partner and probably an increasingly, maybe at times a bigger partner. And of course, we saw the potential impact of that when soybean oil went to, I think, all-time record highs, as high as 70 cents or something like that. So renewable diesel is here to stay. The expansion is going to come really, really quickly. It's going to create a new base of demand for all oil seeds, but certainly soybeans. And of course, canola, that's 45 to 50% oil. It's going to be a big deal. So don't let that slip away from your stream of consciousness, even though we haven't talked about it too much lately.
Major energy companies, including BP, Chevron, Marathon, Phillips 66, and Shell, have announced or already added renewable diesel production to a growing lineup of carbon-cutting fuels. Last month, Chevron Corp. announced it's collaborating with agribusiness firms Corteva Inc. and Bunge to produce renewable fuels from winter canola hybrids in the southern United States. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, last week the National Milk Producers Federation and the U.S. Dairy Export Council announced the signing of a set of principles and a new partnership with the National Agricultural Organizations, or FARM, from Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, Uruguay, Chile, Bolivia, and Colombia. The set of principles are designed to constructively engage governments and international organizations around the world on the issues of livestock, agriculture, climate, and trade. NMPF notes that far too often, global convenings and climate proposals reflect ideologies at the expense of science, ignore progress that the industry has made in reducing emissions, and try to impose one-size-fits-all approaches on an industry they do not fully understand. So, in collaboration with the National Agriculture Organizations and the Pan-American Dairy Federation, USDEC and the NMPF will coordinate and support engagements with government officials and international organizations in promoting policies that encourage sustainable productivity growth while taking into consideration the unique needs of the livestock industry as well as profitability for farmers. Now, the partnership is being organized with an eye towards the UN Food Systems Summit stock-taking moment and COP28. That's where organizations will be playing a role in shaping the discussion around agriculture's role in sustainable future. If you'd like to learn more about this, go to the National Milk Producers Federation website, nmpf.org. Well, the North American Meat Institute recently held its 2022 Environmental Awards and Worker Safety Recognition Programs, and Smithfield Foods won awards for its environmental and safety achievements. Stuart Leith, Chief Sustainable Officer for Smithfield, said protecting the environment, including decreasing our carbon footprint, implementing water conservation strategies, and reducing packaging have all been our priorities for decades. He said these priorities are all a part of our constant commitment to producing good food the right way. 5 Smithfield facilities were recognized with the Environmental Recognition Awards that acknowledges commitments to continuous environmental improvement through the development and implementation of the environmental management systems. 40 of the company's facilities were recognized with Tier 4 awards. That's the highest recognition in that category. Also, 29 Smithfield locations earned the organization's highest worker safety recognition awards. Smithfield also earned an honorable mention in the DEI category for its industry-leading programs that attract and retain minority and underrepresented employees and customers. And it's taken a few years, but up in Iowa, the legislature there gave its final approval on a bill that would allow Iowa residents to buy fresh from the farm raw milk. After several failed attempts, the state senate there did approve the final bill and sent it to their governor for her signature. One senator said he's waited 17 years for a raw milk bill to get through the Iowa legislature. The bill's supporters say the raw milk tastes better and has more nutrients, but opponents said it can contain bacteria that are dangerous to children and could spark a public health outbreak. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
United States Dairy takes the lead in a climate coalition. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The National Milk Producers Federation and the U.S. Dairy Export Council have signed a set of principles and a new partnership with national agricultural organizations from several other countries. The countries in the new partnership include Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, Uruguay, Chile, Bolivia, and Colombia. USDEC and the NMPF will coordinate and support engagements with government officials and international organizations in promoting policies that encourage sustainable productivity growth while taking into consideration the unique needs of the livestock industry as well as profitability for farmers. The U.S. dairy groups point out that far too often, they say, global convenings and climate proposals reflect ideals at the expense of science, ignore any progress that the industry already has made in reducing emissions, and try to impose a one-size-fits-all solution on industries that they don't fully understand. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough. As you approach retirement, you might experience a rise in income, often because crop expenses were prepaid and don't offset crop income during your last year of farming. That rise in income can impact your Medicare premium payments. I'll be back in a moment with the details.
Agriculture needs the next generation. Kansas State University's College of Agriculture prepares students through applied learning, internships, and research. Learn more at ag.ksu.edu.
I'll get back to the report in a moment, but I want you to know that Schrader Real Estate and Auction Company has sold farm and ranch land and farm equipment in 40 states. Learn how the Schrader family can help your family. Visit SchraderAuction.com. That's S-C-H-R-A-D-E-R Auction.com. If your income exceeds a certain threshold, your monthly Medicare premium increases. For 2023, the basic premium is $164.90. But if your income exceeds $97,000, it jumps to $230.80. For 2023, your premium is based on your income shown on your 2021 return. The minimum Medicare premium for a married couple this year is $3,957. If your income exceeds $750,000, your annual premium will be $13,452. The calculated premium amount can be abated if your increase in income is due to certain circumstances, such as the final year of retirement or other extraordinary items, such as the death of your spouse, marriage or divorce, natural disaster, the receipt of a settlement payment from a current or former employer, or if the Social Security Administration used outdated or incorrect information in calculating your premium. As you approach retirement, work closely with your tax advisor to ensure you are doing what you can to properly reduce both income and Medicare taxes. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough.
Details on the Pandemic Assistance Revenue Program. Farm Service Agency Administrator Zach Duchenal provides details on the Pandemic Assistance Revenue Program, which eligible producers can apply for by June 2nd.
As we navigate through the end of the national disaster surrounding COVID, we're happy to be able to offer the PARP program, Pandemic Assistance Revenue Program, to producers to help fill in the gaps and catch anybody that we missed with the robust suite of other pandemic assistance that we offered in the last couple of years. So in the Pandemic Assistance Revenue Program, we are allowing producers to elect a reference year that is pre-pandemic and use their allowable gross revenue for calendar year 2020 as a comparison. And if they had a 15% or greater decrease in allowable gross revenue, we're going to be able to provide them some assistance to help mitigate the lingering impacts of the economic reality of the pandemic on their operation.
He adds,
we do not want your tax return. In the construction of these revenue-based programs, though, we wanted to make it easy for producers, and the information that is needed to fill out our forms can be found on your Schedule F in your tax return. You can bring that number to this application. We don't need or want to see your Schedule F. That's certainly not the case. Other forms such as a profit or loss from farming or similar tax documents from 2018 through 2022 are going to be helpful in validating this. Producers should also be aware that these programs have the same requirements as virtually all of our other programs. We'll need you to have a current AD 2047, that's the customer data worksheet, form CCC 902, that's your farm operating plan, the CCC 901, that's member information for legal entities, the highly erodible land conservation and wetland certifications, and the CCC 860 for socially disadvantaged, limited resource, beginning and veteran producers.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Farm employers' labor service compliance posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
We begin the last full week of April, and when the calendar rolls to May, next week attitudes may change at CME. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report for this Monday, April 24th, brought to you by AgriLiquid. A week from today is May 1st, and the calendar gets squeezed a bit more when talking about planting progress. Tonight's progress report may be just enough to keep a little bit of nervousness in the trade, but numbers each week from here certainly take on more weight. Snowmelt in the northern belt keeping flooding an issue there and more further south. December corn, in our view, below 560, leaves little additional downside risk from here. We see corn, soybeans, and wheat taken down a bit too far last week. We see a continued rebound here early week. SureCave fertilizer from AgriLiquid provides season-long potassium fertilizer to your crop and with flexible application methods. Learn about SureCave at agriliquid.com. Live cattle and feeder cattle futures had some technical correcting to do last week. We don't see that correction done just quite yet, though the cattle on feed report from Friday afternoon may slow that process. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
An update on trade with Vietnam. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack discussed some of the details of his visit last week in Vietnam with reporters last Wednesday. Rod Bain reports.
A decade of partnership between the U.S. and Vietnam on various issues, including over time, those involving trade. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack in Vietnam Wednesday told reporters.
I had a chance to meet with the Minister of Agriculture and Rural Development, the Trade Minister, as well as the Prime Minister.
With discussions, including making the case
for Vietnam to continue working to expand access to some of our specialty crops, including nectarines, peaches, lemons, and tangerines. They've just recently opened their market to our grapefruit. Made the case as well that there may be an opportunity as they move from utilizing a blend of bio-based fuel E5 to E10. There's an opportunity as well for expanded imports of U.S. ethanol.
I'm Rod Bain reporting.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
For those of us who love doing lawn and garden work, this is one of our favorite times of the year.
I think the loveliest time of the year is the spring,
don't you?
I do, yes. And it's a good time for the nation's extension lawn and garden experts, too. But it's also that time of year when they start to come out of the woodwork, and we're not talking about termites, right? I hope you're curious now and that you do like a little oddness in your life and maybe a few laughs, because that is what we hope you're going to get on this edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford. When you are an expert whose job it is to handle questions from the public, to try to figure out their problems and fix them, well, you may sometimes run into some questions or problems or suggestions that seem just a bit
crazy. And a lot of times they get these crazy recommendations from their neighbors.
That does not mean that the people themselves are crazy, just that it might seem that way. This from Kansas State University Extension Lawn and Garden expert Dennis Patton. He says sometimes problems are caused by taking the neighbor's yard and garden advice.
The average person gets their lawn and garden advice. It's from their neighbor. And I jokingly tell people, you know, I've talked to your neighbor before. And trust me, you don't want to get your advice from them because I know the crazy things they've asked.
For example,
we get the home remedies from time to time.
Got milk?
You know, milk seems to be a salvation for everything for some reason. Spraying it on, I've heard that one.
Oh yes, milk as weed killer, fertilizer, insect controller should make the dairy producers very happy, except Patton says there's no truth in it. Of course, there are folks who don't use milk to kill weeds. Here's a story about a guy who is much too sophisticated for that. However,
the wife called our office and the husband went out to do weed control. Husband didn't read the label. Husband sprayed the non-selective herbicide all over the lawn and just killed out, from her description, about three-fourths of it. You can just see the trails where he took the little wand and just had this trail throughout the lawn where he killed it all out with not reading the label, didn't understand some herbicides work differently. Let me just say she was not happy with her husband.
Well, to keep this even as far as gender goes, though, this next one is a hot one, and we do mean hot.
We have an insect called fall webworm, which these webs get all over the end of the branches of the tree. So this call, I had a call from a woman, her tree wasn't leafing out this year. And we went through everything under the face of the earth trying to figure out why this tree wasn't leafing out. And then finally she goes, well, you know, last fall I had these fall webworms, so I took a torch and burned them out of the tree. Do you think that would have killed the tree? Bingo.
Tree go, too, unfortunately. You remember what Smokey Bear used to say?
Only you can prevent forest fires.
But Dennis Patton's version is...
trees and fire just don't go together.
Ah, but wait, there's more. Here's one from a 1980 interview I did with Deborah Smith, at that time an extension agent in Virginia. One day, this guy comes into her office frantic. Oh, and he says, please, please, Deborah, our hybrid poplar trees. They're dying. They're losing their leaves. You got to save them. So he goes. Deborah sends off the sample he brought in to the university for a diagnosis.
The next day, his wife came in with another branch sample, and she was very agitated as well. I've got to know the answer by the weekend. I'll tell you the reason why. We planted these hybrid poplars as a living fence around our property. Very thick fence and screen from our neighbors. She said, we're having a hot tub party this weekend, and we're nudists. We need those trees as a screen. If the leaves keep falling off like this, the neighbors will start to complain.
Or maybe they won't. But anyway, they fixed it and everybody was happy. So next, we've got a brand new story from Kansas State University horticultural expert Ward Upham. He says there used to be a guy around his town who did some horticultural work.
Every once in a while, he'll do some tree planting for people. And this guy hired him, and he took him down to a neighbor that was down the street and said, I want a tree exactly like that. He said, okay. And so a week later, he had a tree that looked exactly like his neighbor's. When he drove past his neighbor's, his tree was missing.
Oh, wow. He dug it up in one place and moved it to
another. Yes. Yep.
Is this guy still running around free?
No, that was years and years ago.
Well, let's hope so anyway. That's all the time we have for today. Thank goodness you have been half listening, at least, to Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section. When Dad injured his back... when your basketball star tore his ACL, opioids helped with the pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Opioids are powerful, pain-reducing prescription medicines, but most people who are prescribed opioids don't finish their prescriptions. So millions of unused opioids are sitting in homes across the country, and tragically, more than 100 Americans die every day from overdoses involving opioids. What can you do to protect your family? Remove the risk of unused opioids from your home. Pills, patches, or syrups in drawers, purses, and cabinets. Anywhere they might be hiding. To find out how to dispose of them properly, visit www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the show. Today we have part two of my conversation with Stanislaus County Sheriff's Department Sheriff Jeff Dirksky and Sergeant Brock Condent on the topic of rural ag crime.
Right. Now, Sheriff, can you sort of elaborate more on the relationship between the Ag Community and Farm Bureau? Before we started, actually, Anna mentioned that you guys attend some of their monthly meetings. So talk to me about the importance of that, if you will.
Yeah, and Brock kind of nailed it, that the relationship is the key part, because process-wise, for us, an investigation is an investigation. Kind of doesn't really matter the origin of it or the location of it. From our standpoint, again, it's kind of the same process. But that relationship is absolutely critical. Back in my own days as the ag crimes detective, I already said probably a quarter of the victims were already in my personal phone. I would get calls, you know, that crimes that had not even been reported yet. So it's not like they had called 911 and said, hey, someone is here. They're calling me directly. And we encourage, because it is like for our ag community, it gives them that reassurance that we are truly committed to helping them out. And kind of a two-way street, because we often, like if we have a suspect vehicle, let's say, and we have a picture of it from some source, right, we drop it out, you know, internally to our organization, but we also put it out to the ag community and regularly get back, oh, hey, I've seen that vehicle 10 times in the last week in my area, you know, west side, east side, whatever. It's from this address or the place on the corner of X and Y Street. And that relationship gives us then kind of operating or information that we can operate on. And so they help us solve the crimes that are impacting their community. You know, and we had kind of briefly already about the, like some of these animal activists and so on. And where we get a lot of our first information that the activists are in our, from the ag community. I regularly get contacts from either our poultry producers, you know, maybe dairy, whatever, and say, hey, we've got some suspicious looking folks out here. Can you have your guys check on it? And sure enough, you know, it turns out that it's somebody associated with some sort of an activist group. And so that relationship is critical. And we do, we go to kind of, you know, my position is that either the ag crimes detectives, Brock, maybe the lieutenant, or I mean, up to me, is at one of us is at virtually every Farm Bureau meeting or event just to continue to foster that relationship.
Right, right. How often, I mean, you talked about the connection between the grower and yourself and then being able to sort of spot out where a vehicle is and maybe if they've seen a crime actually happened. So how often are arrests made for rural crime or are punishment taken? Are those considered wins for you guys? And if so, can you elaborate more on that?
Yeah, definitely. It is a win when we're able to gather enough evidence to identify someone and, you know, make the arrest and make sure that they are held accountable for the theft. But, you know, that doesn't just stop with the arrest. It, you know, goes through the court proceedings. And really, we follow that process all the way through. And, you know, it's not always the greatest. Sometimes you have somebody who beats the case or somebody who bails out, you know, because their bail is lowered. And they go right back out and commit another crime while they're out. And you have to go rearrest them. But it definitely is a win when we're able to put someone away. But, you know, I'll be the first one to tell you there's no shortage of thieves out there. There's always somebody who is out looking to take things that don't belong to them.
Right. Yeah. We talked a little bit about, you know, the range of the loss or damage and how, you know, it could be $100 to hundreds of thousands of dollars. In California, and maybe Sheriff, you can answer this question, when does theft become a felony and does rural crime ever become a federal crime?
Well, let's see. We'll start with the federal crime side first. I am not aware of any applicable federal charges, unless potentially it's something that would be going across state lines. But that is, I know, Brock, if you're aware of anything different, chime in. But I'm not really aware of anything that we would deal with on the federal side. But depending on the product to trigger the felony, it's either going to be $950 or $400. There are some, the general rule in the state of California is it becomes a felony at $950, but there are some ag products that will trigger that at $400. So the answer is, like so much stuff in this profession, it depends. But yeah. What I tell the ag community is don't worry about that. Don't get wrapped up as to whether or not you think it's a felony or a misdemeanor. Get us the information. Give us, you know, whatever you may have, whatever evidence you think you have, whoever you think may have done it, and let us run with it. When I was the ag crimes detective, my single biggest case was a result of it was a trailer theft that had some equipment on it on Christmas morning of 2009.
And, oh, man.
Yeah, 5:40 in the morning. I distinctly remember it because there was some surveillance footage of it from a neighbor. But the reason I bring this case up is it was a huge case. A couple people went to prison. We recovered thousands and thousands of dollars of stolen property. We got a weed grow, some meth, a bunch of weapons. And that's not really the point. The point is that I never solved the original case that I started investigating. The stolen trailer and the equipment on it disappeared. They got chopped up and sold off, but we never recovered of that. But during the course of the investigation, we found so many other crimes that these people went to prison. And so I would always tell farmers, don't worry about, you know, the case. Just give it to us and let us go.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination,
our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The inaugural Western Agricultural and Environmental Law Conference is coming up May 4th and 5th at the Peppermill Reno Resort. Director of the National Agricultural Law Center, Harrison Pittman, shared some of the details of the agenda.
We'll have a 2023 Farm Bill and Related Federal Issues panel. We'll have a session on solar leases, solar contracts, another on legal ethics in the cannabis industry, cooperative conservation under the Endangered Species Act. We'll have a panel on Perishable Agricultural Commodities Act and related produce laws. We'll have a session on that will provide a legal and political update on the Colorado River Basin, one on foreign ownership of ag lands in the western states, which has been a huge issue nationally. But interestingly, when we started planning this conference, there weren't any laws enacted yet out west, and now we have that. They're leading the way nationally in laws that have been actually passed by legislatures and signed by governors. And then we'll round it out with a session on Prop 65 and what it means outside of California, a session on the waters of the United States, and more kind of a practical look at advising farmers, landowners, and lenders, and then another session on groundwater, states' comparative approaches on and recent developments with groundwater, and then a state planning and water law. The audience for this is attorneys and non-attorney ag professionals who work in these issue areas, and we have a great mix of people who are registered and will be attending.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network. In today's Agronomic Minute, brought to you by UPL, a leader in sustainable crop management solutions for California's orchards and vineyards. And we're joined by Technical Services Manager for Biosolutions for UPL, Cassie Reeser, to talk about grapes and diseases that can be problematic for growers. And now things have been substantially wetter this year than the past couple of years. And so, Cassie, even though the rain is mostly behind us now, there has been significantly more moisture out in vineyards. So what kind of concerns might growers be having when it comes to botrytis?
Yeah, so according to, you know, the UCIPM website, which is a great resource, prolonged periods of warm and moist conditions, and especially susceptible wine grape varieties like Zinfandel, paired with elevated nitrogen levels, dense canopies, can promote botrytis outbreaks. These infections can occur during bloom, which entered through the stigma of the flower and lay dormant until the sugar content in the berries increase. And so late season infections become more severe when that relative humidity exceeds 92%. Free moisture is present on the fruit surfaces and temperatures are anywhere from 58 to 82 degrees. So when grapes in a condensed cluster can end up cracking due to pressure against each other later in the season, it can create an ideal entry point and promote the spread of botrytis. So making matters worse, these ripe berries with the sugar can attract fruit flies and bees, who then can spread botrytis from plant to plant by carrying spores on their bodies.
And now, based on the amount of moisture vineyards have been experiencing this season, and now with temperatures set to rise, it seems like growers might expect to be dealing with more botrytis problems this year than maybe they're used to?
Yes, yeah. With the increase in moisture, you tend to, you know, you have a little bit more vigor in the soil to aid in plant canopy. So you might have to do some more cultural controls. So that means leafing or maintaining kind of the openness in a canopy in a grape canopy or the structure. So making sure the leaves are removed from the fruit zone, allowing airflow, can really help from a cultural standpoint for botrytis control.
And on top of some of those cultural controls growers might be able to implement, what are some of the materials that are available that can help growers keep botrytis problems at bay?
Yeah, so PHD is one of our trusted fungicide offerings, and it offers effective control and has a unique mode of action that becomes a really important resistance management tool for tough diseases on grapes. It is the only product in FRAC Group 19, which again makes it a great tank mix partner with other fungicides, and it's fast acting and is very tank mix compatible. So for botrytis control, coverage within the berry cluster is going to be key. It's contact based. PHD should be applied at veraison and then 7 days prior to harvest. So the benefit of PHD is that it does have a 0-day pre-harvest interval and a 4-hour re-entry interval, making it a really great option for disease management sprays, especially closer to harvest.
And lastly here, for anyone interested in maybe learning more about if that might be a good option for their operation, where can they get some more information?
Yeah, they can go to upl-ltd.com/US to look at our current products, resources, and ways to get in contact with us.
Well, very good. And again, this has been the latest installment of the Agronomic Minute, a weekly segment made possible through a content partnership with UPL.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.